Dad, why did you name me after something that's bad?
Oh, we didn't.
Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law doesn't mean that something bad will happen. It means that whatever can happen will happen.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
You have no idea when you're coming back.
We must confront the reality of interstellar travel.
Murph, I love you. Forever.
What's up, guys, and welcome to The Fiction Fix, the Screen Junkies' guide to everything. Your one-stop shop to film, TV, and everything in between. I'm Ben.
I'm Rohan.
And I'm Marty.
And we got so many reviews in store for you guys today. There have been so many great movies that have come out, and we've gone out and we've seen them all. We've gone through university since for the year. We've done exams, but now we're heads down to focus on making an incredible podcast for you guys.
Except for me.
Except for Martin. He's still at university, unfortunately, or Tafe doing graphic design, which is incredible.
I draw pictures.
Yeah, he does. But Rohan and I are done, so...
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, I know. That was a battle and a half. So good to get through that.
Don't rub it in.
So yeah, we got some incredible movies to review for you guys today. What's some of the latest movie news that you guys have been keeping up to date with? I mean, obviously, there is a lot of Marvel and DC news that we will get to in a later podcast, I feel, because there's so much going on regarding Black Panther, Doctor Strange, Avengers 2, the trailers that have come out.
And you guys would have seen a whole lot of that stuff on our Facebook page, if you've liked it. News about Marvel has been, quite plentiful recently.
So. It's been, at least one thing every week, one major thing, including Captain America Civil War, which we predicted earlier in an earlier podcast, but it's massive news, especially for people who... actually, are pretty well known in people who are well affiliated, affiliated, people who know a lot about the lore of Marvel and the Avengers and all that, like myself and like Rohan and Marty. So we're really excited about it, but we'll have all that in detail and we'll discuss it all in a later podcast. Some really interesting casting choices for Black Panther and for, as well, Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
And also DC's been in the news a bit with their movie announcements. Lots of different stuff going on. With rumors about a new Joker, even, but... Yes.
Ooh, well, that's a juicy little...
Yeah, it is. I mean, we posted on the Facebook page who it was, just in a little... in a little line, and if you missed it, then go back to our Facebook page and check it out. But there are rumors for a new Joker in the Sinister Six, or is it Suicide Squad? Sinister Six is the Spider-Man spinoff. The Suicide Squad is what it's going to be, is what the Joker is supposedly going to be in, featuring a recent Oscar winner. But if you guys don't know, check out our Facebook page or wait till next episode.
Yeah, well. The other thing that's kind of been interesting that happened very recently is there's been a little bit of James Bond rumors going around.
Yes, have you guys heard about this?
Yes, I've heard the new James Bond. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we posted on the Facebook page as well. So again, if you haven't heard about it, stay up to date. Check out our Facebook page and follow us.
Shameless plug for ourselves.
I feel like we're okay to do that here. It's a safe space, guys. It's okay.
It's a safe space.
Right, podcast.
Sharing circle.
Yeah, and I feel that this casting choice that they've released is actually quite good.
Yeah, I'm excited. I want it to be true because it would just make my year, really.
Yeah, because there are rumors coming out. Again, rumors, they're not confirmed or anything, but in a similar way to Doctor Strange being rumored to be portrayed by a particular actor. The villain for Bond 24 is rumored to be played by...
What's his name? Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz. Christoph Waltz, okay.
I every time I hear him, I'm like, Christopher Walken or Christopher Mintz-Plasse, and neither of those are close, but they both share similar names.
Yeah, I mean, Christoph Waltz is an incredible actor. We know him from his Oscar-winning performances in Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds, the two Quentin Tarantino films. So we know that he can play incredible villains, as well as incredible anti-heroes, I guess.
Yeah.
And he has this real complexity about him and this real finesse to his art form. And I feel like if he does eventuate into playing the villain for Bond 24, I feel like we have an incredible movie in store.
Yeah.
Because it's directed by the same guy who directed Skyfall. And if that's going to be... If Bond 24 is going to be anything similar, then we've got something great in store for us.
What we've seen, like, recently is this almost invigoration of the James Bond franchise. It got a little bit weird towards the end of the Pierce Brosnan stage, and I think Quantum of Solace, I feel like we can all agree, was a little bit of a... One of those movies you kind of want to forget.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But Skyfall was really, really good. The soundtrack was amazing. Obviously, the song by Adele, the title song, was huge.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited. I've been holding out for Bond 24 for quite a while. I mean, since 2012 when Skyfall came out. That was so big. And so I have quite, like, high expectations now, seeing that Christoph Waltz might be the villain. Like, that makes me really excited for it.
Yeah, I feel like you've touched on a really interesting topic, which is that a lot of film series and a lot of TV shows recently have gotten to this, and even actors, have gotten to this new stage where they've kind of gone into realms of weirdness and oddities, and they kind of, like, haven't really been great actors or series. Until recently, when they've brought out, you know, a new film, and it's just been out of nowhere, like Matthew McConaughey, the McConaughey sense. We have Survivor's really been picking up. We have so many different series that have just come out of nowhere and reinvigorated themselves with this new spark, and Skyfall definitely did that for James Bond. I feel like that's a really important point that you touched on there. Because even though Casino Royale was good...
I did like Casino Royale.
And it introduced us to Daniel Craig as James Bond. Mm. It kind of lost it a bit with Quantum of Solace. But then Skyfall came out, and there were... I had low expectations for that personally after Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, Quantum of Solace, I lost all faith in Daniel Craig as Bond.
But then... Oh, I think Daniel Craig is good as Bond, but...
The movie was... The plot line was just...
The writing was pretty bad.
Yeah, it wasn't...
I don't feel like Quantum of Solace was a very well... thought out movie.
I don't think they played...
I don't understand what happened in Quantum of Solace still.
Yeah, I don't think they really treated Bond with the respect that he has. Yeah. Really, especially, they kind of undermine his character a bit, which is okay when you're in, like, Skyfall and you need to give him this sort of depth to him, but then in Quantum of Solace, it just kind of... It was a bit too much for me, the way they handle his character and the way he interacted with the other characters and the way he was integrated into the plot. It didn't fit seamlessly into the actual film.
Mm, I completely agree.
What are your opinions on Daniel Craig as Bond?
Well, in Casino Royale, I quite liked him as James Bond, but I think Skyfall kind of clinched it for me. Yeah, as somebody who's... Yeah. Like, I grew up watching all of the James Bond movies when I was little, and so I've kind of seen all of the different Bonds, and I really, really liked Daniel Craig. Like, for me, like, Pierce Brosnan was always my favourite Bond. Like,
really? That's interesting.
The movies, because, I mean, his movies were so cheesy, but they were, like, he had that kind of, that sophisticated, like, suave smugness about him that I just thought was awesome. But Daniel Craig as James Bond, like, I didn't like him up until Skyfall, and in Skyfall, it really just clinched it for me. I think he's great.
I mean, I personally thought that, you know, you always have Sean Connery as the best.
Yeah.
With Roger Moore as well up there. Pierce Brosnan, I felt like he was... His first two Bond films were good, but then the latter two were not as great.
Yeah, Die Another Day was quite questionable.
Yeah. But, I mean, it just goes to show how well Daniel Craig has done in that the Bond films were going out of style, I suppose, with the last two Pierce Brosnan films. And, yes, Daniel Craig struggled to get it back up there with the first two that he made, but then Skyfall hit, and all of a sudden, over $1 billion... and an Oscar for the music and sound editing. Actually, I think it's two Oscars they won. And obviously, Skyfall was incredible, and I think it was probably the best Bond film ever made, personally. But I just think that Daniel Craig has really brought a lot of depth to the character of Bond. Stuff that I wasn't expecting when I first saw him in Casino Royale.
Yeah,
but
I didn't have when I first saw the trailer for Casino Royale. There's I don't know if you guys remember, at the end of the trailer, there's this really, really, like, very specific scene where the camera pans on Daniel Craig's face and he kind of does these, like, duck lips. And he does, it's almost like a James Bond Blue Steel, like, like a look into the camera.
Gorgeous.
And when I first saw that, like, that was 2006 or 7.
Yeah, it's 2007,
and
I think.
So, like, I saw that trailer when I was at the movies with my parents, I think. And, like, I just could not stop talking about it because he looked just, like, I used to call him Monkey Face. Because the face that he pulled in that trailer was just, like, Monkey Face James Bond. And I could never take him seriously. Now, 7 years later?
Yeah, you know, something like that,
yeah. I can, like, look at Daniel Craig now and say without a doubt, like, that is James Bond.
Yeah.
He really embodies that character well.
Yeah, he's really come into, he's come into the character.
Yeah.
Like, with the start of his arc as James Bond, like, that's what I call him, like, as each Bond goes in and out. Like, this particular arc, he really started out, like, and it felt like any other action movie, almost.
Yeah, it's very generic really a bit,
yeah.
I recall mostly just cars, explosions, and a lot of shattered glass and guns.
Yeah.
But it's really gone a bit further than that in Skyfall, and, like Quantum of Solace did bring it back, but Skyfall really came around to a better...
Yeah, I think that was well shown in Skyfall, where he didn't rely on gadgets that much. I mean, there was really only one or two gadgets in the actual film, like a gun and something else, I can't remember. Maybe the car, I don't know. But that was it. And I feel like this reinvigoration of the series has tried to rely less on the gadgets, more on the characters, and it's really come into its own in Skyfall, where Daniel Craig, portraying James Bond, has really had this sort of personal conflict there, and he's really portrayed it very well, to the point where, I mean, inventions and cool little gadgets aren't really needed anymore.
Yeah,
whereas the actual series founded itself upon this spy and the agency that had these cool gadgets and could do these cool things, whereas now it's mostly about the man.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
I think it's important because, like, everyone knows you can do cool things with the technology now. It's not as far-fetched as it used to be. A lot of the things that you see in these spy movies, like in the old spy movies, are like, besides the ridiculous super weapon, the death rays, etc.
Yeah.
A lot of them are very possible. A lot of these gadgets are actually quite possible, and some exist. And it kind of took away from it because we had it now. It's kind of out of fashion.
I think
we're reaching a point nowadays where we really appreciate character build-up in stories, and you can't just have action movies. I mean, like, you have Avengers and stuff that are making bucket loads of cash, but it's because the characters are actually built up.
Yeah, you give them a whole movie or two to build up.
I mean, if you don't believe that, just look at The Dark Knight. The reason why The Dark Knight is so loved, so critically acclaimed, and also so commercially successful, is because it wasn't just a stock standard action superhero movie. It's because the characters were relatable, the characters were sympathetic in some points, the characters had this depth and this emotion to them that we could understand, or in some cases, like the Joker, we couldn't really understand, but that's what made them so interesting, is these characters, and rather than just massive Michael Bay explosions.
Yeah.
Harking back to our last podcast.
Explosion noise.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think that Skyfall had going for it, and one thing that I think will be great for Bond 24, is this idea of moving away from the original James Bond novels, because Skyfall was one of the first movies in the James Bond series to have an original plot.
Really?
And they ran out of books from Casino Royale, and so I think that it's very interesting to see that Bond 24 is going to... Because, I mean, we saw in Skyfall. Skyfall has a very, very good plot. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, I won't spoil it. But it's got a lot of very good twists and turns that kind of had me on the edge of my seat when I watched it. And I think that Bond 24 can probably take a note, a lesson out of, from Skyfall.
Mm.
Because the actual writing and the story of Skyfall was really, really good. I think that that's something that I can kind of hope for in Bond 24, that they will be able to continue that in, all of the original stories that they're coming out with.
Yeah, I think that's a big part because of the departure from the original writing, because that, all the original writing, that's fairly old actually, right?
Mm. Yeah, those books have been coming out for a very long time.
Yeah, they've been around for quite a while. Casino Royale, I think, was the first. And they made, I think, two films of that. The first one wasn't that successful.
No.
I think that was...
It predated Sean Connery's James Bond.
No, it didn't. I don't think it predated. I think it just... it wasn't part of the main franchise.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
It was made by a different company that didn't tie in. I think that was... It included a Bond that wasn't played by Sean Connery, I think. It was played by some other guy who obviously hasn't become famous because of that. but yeah, I'm really excited for Bond 24.
Yeah.
Got the same sort of... The same... core of the crew that was there last time in Skyfall, so I'm really excited about it. And obviously Christoph Waltz, big expectations from him.
Yeah
I
think that's going to be something we can look forward to, and I mean it'll definitely be something we make a podcast on later on.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There are a whole bunch of trailers that are out. There's Benedict Cumberbatch's The Imitation Game, which is about a British spy trying to decode German codes or whatever. Looks really interesting, and the reviews have so far been pretty good, so I'm definitely going to check that out, but that's a kind of smaller one.
Yeah, did you see the video that Benedict Cumberbatch did? It was like a weird interview where he was doing like 21 celebrity impressions.
No, I haven't.
It was, no, definitely check that out. It was one of the highlights of my week, considering I've had exams for the last 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a big highlight. But Benedict Cumberbatch does very good celebrity impressions.
Yeah, I hear him and Tom Hiddleston also does pretty good ones. Also, Hugh Jackman's film Chappie has gotten a trailer release, which looks really interesting. I mean, it's about a robot and like the whole AI, artificial intelligence stuff.
This isn't the first time that Hugh Jackman has done an AI kind of movie.
No, Real Steel.
Real Steel, yeah.
Was one of them.
Oh god, Real Steel.
No, it wasn't too bad.
Real Steel was the Rocky of robots.
It was actually, yeah. Well, I didn't go watch it because I was a little bit, apprehensive. Mm. But I remember you telling me that you really liked it. Liked it.
Real Steel. Oh, yeah, Real Steel. It wasn't too bad. I mean...
Yeah, I have my reservations, but it was an okay movie.
Yeah. Also, other ones, Exodus, Gods and Kings, which is Ridley Scott's new movie. That comes out very soon, at the beginning of December, with Christian Bale and... Mr. Edgerton, Joel Edgerton.
It's essentially the Prince of Egypt in live action. It's that old cartoon movie.
Like, it'll be like Prince of Egypt, like with like 1,000 times the violence. Well, I don't know, 1,000 times zero
because it's live action. It's very violent.
Yeah, I mean, from the trailer alone.
Also, it's not sponsored by some Christian company.
No, just Christian Bale.
Yeah,
nailed that one. Yeah.
Nice one.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. There are a number of other Egypt movies that are coming out. I think there's another one called Gods of Egypt, which has Jeffrey Rush in it.
There's a real big Eastern thing going on at the moment.
Sort of. I mean, it's not quite Prince of Persia Eastern, even though it has Ben Kingsley in it. Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Oh yeah, it's not that far east, but it's sort of like the focus is moved off like a European sort of area. Like it's a very just in general, it's sort of like movies seem to shift in like in trends
towards
different areas, and we seem to be seeing more a lot more in like that sort of region, like a lot more stories from that region and play that area.
In what way? What other ones have come out?
Now wait 5 seconds while I think of them. I don't know.
I
know there are a lot.
We talked about the new like X-Men movie. I don't know. Am I allowed to say
a new X-Men movie?
I mean the trailer, the sneak peek for the new X-Men movie.
Oh right. Oh yeah. The little teaser at the end, the end of credits scene. I mean, yeah. I suppose I think that's a bit of a long stretch, especially since like the upcoming X-Men Apocalypse film isn't going to be set there. That's just like a teaser into the character that it's going to be based off.
It starts in Egypt.
True. Yes. Well, obviously, if you haven't seen X-Men Days of Future Past and haven't seen the end of credits scene, you have no clue what we're talking about. So go check that out. If you haven't seen X-Men Days of Future Past already, what are you doing with your life? Please go check it out, because it's still personally one of my favorite movies of the year.
And watch like, Hugh Jackman's rippling muscle.
Well, it's actually such a good movie. Like,
it actually is.
I went and saw it with... Generally, seeing movies in a group of people more than like 3 or 4 is probably a bad idea because you'll end up talking. But I went and saw X-Men Days of Future Past with about 4 or 5 people.
Dangerous.
And even people came who don't particularly like superhero movies. And they loved it. Like, they thought it was really good. So, if you haven't seen X-Men Days of Future Past, I actually really recommend it. You'll probably really like it. It's quite funny.
I mean, we've done a podcast on it. So go check out our podcast on it. Yeah, we all gave it above 4. Yeah. So go check it out, that podcast. That was like episode 4 or something, wasn't it? Yeah. Ages ago. That, our mutant podcast. That's right. So go check that out. That's already out on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever. But anyway, I think it's about time that we get into our
movies.
We got so many to get through. We got six of them today. What are we going to start off with?
Well,
because I mean, the movies we're going to go through in this order are Gone Girl, Tammy, Fury, Annabelle, the new horror movie, Boyhood, which is the film that was filmed over like 12 years
or
10
Richard
years.
Linklater's new film.
Yeah, and also the major one, which is the big theme of this podcast, Matthew McConaughey's
Interstellar.
All right. We got lots to talk about with Interstellar, so we'll probably have a break after the first five films and then go in depth, spoiler free, I should say.
Yes.
About Interstellar, and yes, every review will be spoiler free, so no need to worry about that. We'll put times in the description to say which times each review starts, because I feel like with this many reviews, people are going to get lost. They're not going to want to listen to one review in order to get to another. So we'll put times in the description to make sure you guys know exactly what we're talking about. Gone Girl, I feel like we should start off with.
Okay.
So the premise for Gone Girl, Rohan.
Okay, so Gone Girl is a very complicated, very intricate story, and without giving anything away, because the storyline for Gone Girl is incredible. The movie pretty much follows Nick, who is played by Ben Affleck, who has a very ordinary morning and comes back to his house to find his wife gone and a little bit of a struggle taking place. And so the movie pretty much follows his journey in trying to find out what happened to his wife, who is gone, hence the title Gone Girl. But I think that there's a lot to be said about this movie that starts off with a very simple kind of generic plot.
Yeah.
And transcends into something like so incredible and so amazing. I was honestly so thrilled. And I'd read the book before I'd seen the movie, but I was so thrilled going into this movie and seeing the story and the acting alone.
Yeah, oh my god. Wow, the acting itself was just like, just looking at that first and foremost, it was, the actors are knocked out of this part.
Yeah, before saying anything else, Rosamund Pike, who plays the wife in Gone Girl,
don't even get me started.
I honestly think she will win the award for best actress for this movie.
You really?
Yeah.
I reckon she has a very high likelihood of being nominated for best actress. Maybe best supporting actress, maybe?
Well, she could potentially be. It depends on how much, I don't know how much screen time.
Yeah, I suppose it depends.
Is
I mean,
the requirement.
Yeah, I mean, it totally depends. But I feel like she
that role.
I feel like if she's not nominated at least for an acting Oscar, then it's kind of a robbery.
Yeah, no, definitely. She was absolutely incredible. And if you go to see this movie, all you have to do is go purely for her.
Yeah, I mean, Ben Affleck himself, well, let's not take away from him. He was really, really good.
Yeah.
Obviously, he didn't have as many intense scenes as Rosamund Pike did. But he fit the role perfectly, and I couldn't have chosen anyone else to fit his role, actually.
Yeah.
I feel like Ben Affleck did supremely well, and Rosamund Pike, though, whew,
yeah,
my god, she really knocked it out of this park.
She really did. She got that character of Amy down so well.
I hadn't even heard of her much, apart from, a couple of movies that she's done, but she's really been kind of in the background of Hollywood.
Yeah,
Ben Affleck was really what they sold the Gone Girl to us off. Rosamund Pike wasn't really a big deal, but then all of a sudden when you see the movie, you really understand that this film is dependent on Rosamund Pike.
It is her film for all, it's about both Nick and Amy, but at the end of the day, for me, it became Amy's movie.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. But the thing is, I've heard a lot of criticism about Ben Affleck's portrayal of Nick.
In what way?
People found the character a little bit short-sighted and kind of dumb and slow. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that in the book, that character is pretty much written that way.
Yeah.
The character of Nick isn't supposed to be this super genius, this guy who is going to go to the end of the earth and he knows how to manipulate the media and all that stuff. He's not supposed to be that guy. He's supposed to be the guy who is kind of swept up in this tornado of chaos and the disappearance of his wife, and who is kind of struggling to figure out exactly what's happening and struggling to reconcile, you know, his own identity with what's happening in the media and what's happening in the world. And I think that that's something that's important for people to know when going into this movie. Don't expect the character of Nick to be this, like, super genius,
yeah.
this guy who is, I don't know.
He just has the answers.
Yeah,
there, you know?
Because he's flawed, as yeah. all people are. That character is flawed. And I think that it's actually a testament to the writing.
Mm.
Like, Gillian Flynn, when writing that character, I think it's a testament to her in writing a character that is very human.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of people nowadays really find relatable characters that are supremely smart. I mean, you've got Tyrion Lannister from Game of Thrones,
yeah.
Bryan Cranston's
Walter White
yeah.
from
Breaking Bad. People really, really love those characters, and so maybe in this film they came into it really wanting to relate to that sort of character, but when they were presented with Ben Affleck's kind of everyday man, the man who kind of does things that he thinks are good, but also he's got some flaws as well.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to grasp that. But I think that's really important that they've made this man, who is an everyday man, with his flaws. Yes, he does bad things, he's not a great person, but it's really important that they have this character there so that there's this kind of, like, empathy with him, because we're not all perfect, we're not all geniuses,
yeah.
and I think that it makes it far more realistic that way. They make Ben Affleck an easily relatable person.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Ben Affleck suited the role very well.
Yeah, but I mean, like, going apart from the main characters, there are a couple of very good supporting characters as well. Like, Neil Patrick Harris's role in this movie, without giving too much away, is very, very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, if you can imagine, like, a really nice guy, classic Neil Patrick Harris, except a little less comical, a little less witty.
Yeah.
Just that kind of, like, stock standard nice Neil Patrick Harris. Similar to, like, the real Neil Patrick Harris, except less animated
and
less comical.
He was very kind of socially maladjusted, that character.
Yes.
And I found it very interesting to watch because we build up a lot of this Neil Patrick Harris vision. Anybody who's seen How I Met Your Mother and Harold and Kumar, they have this specific vision of Neil Patrick Harris as this kind of, like, badass, like, a little bit of a
yeah.
womanizer kind of character. And for some people I know, walking into this movie and seeing Neil Patrick Harris play this very placid, kind of pulled back character
yeah.
was a little bit awkward. But once you're into the swing of the movie, because the movie is a little bit long. It's not like Interstellar long, but it's like...
Yeah, I think
it's about 2 hours, a bit over 2 hours.
We'll touch on that a bit.
Yeah,
but
like... once you're into the atmosphere of the movie, which gets quite fast-paced from about halfway through,
yeah.
the whole Neil Patrick Harris thing, I feel like if you're engrossed in the movie enough, you don't really think about it until after the movie finishes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's odd to first take a look at it and see Neil Patrick Harris in this role that people aren't really known for him playing. I mean,
yeah.
I've seen a movie called Beastly, which has Vanessa Hudgens and Alex Pettifer in it. And in that, he played a serious blind tutor or whatever. So I've seen that side of him before.
Mm.
But it is odd to see a more serious role that he's taken on. And it's really good, because I think he's
yeah.
a great actor.
He really is.
And since Doogie Howser, which is a TV series
yeah.
that he won Emmys for Best Actor, he has really shown himself to be a great actor,
yeah.
just more in the comical roles. But he can pull these off, and he's done very well.
Well, Neil Patrick Harris definitely has a very natural comedic timing. Like, I'm currently reading his autobiography, which is a choose-your-own-adventure book.
Oh, yeah, choose-your-own-biography.
It's literally
that, yeah.
sitting on my bedside table right now. And
it's really clever.
It is one of the funniest books I've ever read in my life. And, like, I have biographies by... Tina Fey, by Sarah Silverman, Amy Poehler's one as well, and they're hilarious. But Neil Patrick Harris's book, even though he's not like an actual comedian, is incredibly funny. It's one of the funniest books I've ever read.
I think, yeah, comedian is a loose term. I feel like we could classify him as a comedian because he is a funny guy.
Yeah, well,
he's got
a natural... Yeah, he's got a natural comedic...
Yeah.
And I think that it's interesting to see that he can be such a funny guy on TV and in writing and in interviews, and then play very, very serious characters. And
yeah.
Gone Girl is one of those movies that it's very, very... I mean, I want to say intense. It's got a lot of comedy in it, but, like, It's a drama first and foremost.
Yeah.
And so that character of Neil Patrick Harris is very, very important to that.
Yeah. I feel like another surprise that was in the film, acting-wise, was a character played by someone who we wouldn't expect to be, you know, a good actor, who is Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
Tyler Perry is most well-known recently for almost destroying the last season of Survivor with some little hints he gave, or little suggestions he made to CBS, saying, hey, how about you include this in the new season? And they put it in, and it almost destroyed the season, which made a lot of fans very upset.
I don't even know what happened, frankly.
No, it's all right. Check out the season, you guys will know. But Tyler Perry hasn't really built himself up to be a great actor. However, in this film, he plays a lawyer who understands how to play the media. He represents criminals who he thinks can win, maybe? I think he represents, supposed criminals, I should say.
Yeah.
He represents people who he finds to be a challenge to
win. Yeah, and interesting.
Yeah, interesting, with that sort of story that intrigues him. And he actually played this character very, very well. I was surprised when I went into it, and I totally expected Tyler Perry to be, you know, the Megan Fox of the movie, just to completely destroy it. But, like, yes. Tyler Perry was actually awesome. He fit the role really perfectly, and his comedic style was not as in your face as I was expecting it to be.
Well, the humor of the movie is quite well. It's subtle. It's also dark.
Yeah.
So having like overt comedy within the midst of this like really intense drama probably wouldn't work. But it was almost cynical, sarcastic, dark humor.
Yeah.
Like that worked really, really well.
Yeah, I feel like in this movie they had a lot to be wary of, in that there are so many circumstances in real life of people being lost and stuff like that, and they had to be careful with the way they portrayed it, showing characters in sympathetic light, but also like integrating humor in a way that makes characters relatable, but not mocking the idea of losing a loved one, because it is a very serious issue.
Yeah.
But they also needed to touch on a major point of the movie, which was how to play up the media.
Yes.
This was like a major point in the movie.
It's almost one of the, without giving too much away, like it's a very, very crucial crux of the story.
Yeah, and I felt like they played on it really, really well, because they didn't rub it in your face so much that like that it kind of disrespected people in real life who have had loved ones become lost and they've been in front of the media and they've played it up crying or whatever. They haven't rubbed it in our faces so much so that we doubt their stories and that it disrespects them, but it does show that it is a very important element to media in drawing the distinction between who's good and who's bad in the public eye.
Yeah.
And how the public eye isn't necessarily, you know, hasn't got the best perception.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole heap of ideas, like, that come across within the movie about the way that the media sensationalizes news and blows things out of proportion. And, I mean, you see a lot of the way that they depict various characters within the movie. Mm. Exactly the way that people consume this information through the media.
Yeah, and just like unquestioningly.
Yeah, and I think the word consume is quite apt for this.
Yeah.
Because the way that the media kind of presents people facts in this movie is it's almost like they're feeding them this information.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people just believe it.
There's no filter there.
Yeah, exactly. And so when the movie starts dealing with ideas of the way that the media portrays things and the way that people need to act in front of the media, I think that becomes a really interesting kind of like social commentary.
Mm, definitely.
And I think that's something that not only that Gillian Flynn did well in her book, but that David Fincher portrays in the movie, because he does a really good job of kind of creating this almost claustrophobic atmosphere.
Yes,
with the media, with the media presence in the movie.
I mean, like, not just in the way that like the media is always kind of like present at his house and just suffocating him, but it's just this feeling, overbearing presence that like anything he does, anything the police do, the media will have some response to him.
Yeah.
And the question is, in what way will they respond? In what way will they filter this information and portray it to the public? Because there is this overbearing presence there, and you're feeling like it's really, as you said, claustrophobic on the rest of the plot and on Nick, the main character.
Yeah.
The tone of the film is rather dark, and it's kind of gothic in a way, I guess. If you could think of like a modern gothic film, I think this is probably it.
Yeah, it was very, very dark.
Yeah, while some of it was, it wasn't too gory, but it was more shocking.
Yeah.
In the way that they actually dealt with some of these situations and some of these scenes, and it was really dark to a point where it wasn't like disturbing so much so that you'd walk out of the film, but it was enough that you could sit back and you could appreciate the balls that David Fincher had to actually portray this screenplay on the actual big screen.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate the way they did it. They didn't hold back.
No. The movie has a lot of shock value in it.
Yeah.
In a way that's cheesy like in horror movies.
Like
in a way that's kind of that's
stuff,
really
yeah.
effective
yeah.
for what needs to be done with the character development, what needs to be done with the story. Watching the movie, this is a movie that I would definitely see again. Like,
oh, yeah, for sure. I'm buying it on DVD as soon as
I yeah. I mean, this movie is very outstanding. Like, I went into it having mixed kind of expectations.
Yes, me too.
Because I knew that the book was good, but I didn't know how well David Fincher would translate it. But then again, you can't, you know, say this stuff about David Fincher, who's like he's generally a director you can rely upon.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't had like big successes really in the past, but like as we elaborated on, I didn't have very high expectations for it. I hadn't read the book before, so coming to this film, I had no idea what to expect. Much like Interstellar, I tried to avoid myself of spoilers the entire way through before I saw it.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was in the cinema, my friends and I were contemplating, do we see this or do we see Walk Among the Tombstones? And we weren't sure because like there weren't that many that weren't high expectations for this
yeah.
film. But entered the cinema and walked out a completely different person. I mean, it's just that sort of the depth and the complexity that I really appreciate in film, and that us as film reviewers can really appreciate.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the film.
Yeah.
But I would say that it was probably a tad too long. I felt like they could have ended it at a certain point.
Yeah.
But they went a little bit too far, such that it was this halfway point where I wasn't, where like they could have ended it earlier, or if they extended it a bit more, they could have ended it on a satisfying note, but like they stopped it halfway, such that I was kind of like screaming in my head, thinking they haven't finished it completely. It
yeah.
felt unfinished.
Well, the thing about the way that the movie was kind of drawn out was that I found it to be quite an interesting adaptation of what the book does, because the first half of the book is quite slow. For a very specific purpose, and anybody who's seen the movie will kind of realize, or who's read the book will kind of understand exactly why they do that. And then there's a reason that, I mean, I don't know how much I want to talk about the ending, but
Not much.
Yeah, but I mean, you weren't completely satisfied by what
yeah.
happened.
I mean, it was mostly because I felt like they could have ended it at a certain point, and they just dragged on a bit too much, so much so that it went beyond what it could have. It
yeah.
could have had like, and mind you, I love ambiguous endings. However, not to the point where it leaves the audience so unsatisfied and so fueled up with this emotion that they've given us, but then just cutting it short. Ambiguous endings and can be done well. And I just feel like this was done, while yes, it may be following a book, it was just done a little bit too unsatisfyingly. It was resolute in its ending, but just emotionally and morally it was ambiguous, and it just, I felt like personally, like I wasn't satisfied from it.
Yeah. So having read the book already going into the movie, I kind of already knew on what level it would end. And so while watching the movie, everybody has different ideas about what exactly is going to happen by the end of the book. And like, or by the end of the movie. And as you kind of approach the ending, you start to juggle ideas in your head about what's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And so the way that it ends, whilst it's definitely not the most satisfying ending in the world, I think that it was really, really good ending, purely because of the statements that it makes on the characters themselves.
Yeah.
Because the characters go through a lot of development, and the movie only goes for, I mean, the time period, it's not super long.
150 minutes or something.
I mean, like, even just the chronology of the actual movie, from, like, point A to point B.
It's only a couple. It's only like a.
It's like a couple of weeks or like a couple of months.
Yeah, couple of weeks.
I wish I could remember.
Yeah.
But the thing is that over that short span of time, the characters go through a lot and they develop as people. And by the end of the movie, they emerge very different people. Not even very different people, but they just know more about themselves.
Yeah.
And so the way
the
way that it ends, I think, is a really good reflection on where the characters are as people. And so for me, it wasn't satisfying because you want specific things to happen to the characters. You want them to end in a place that is very tailor-made to those characters. But I think that at the end of the day, the ending that they had, and I'm completely bound by spoiler walls here, but at the end of the day, the way that the movie ends, I think, was a very accurate depiction of the actual characters.
I think, yeah, accuracy is definitely there. I can appreciate the ending. Don't get me wrong, I love endings that are morally ambiguous and that are realistic to some extent.
Yeah.
However, I just feel like with this particular example, there's just so much there that they could have done, and I personally didn't feel fulfilled.
Yeah.
And that's just a personal thing. I mean, a lot of people may think, oh yeah, it was artsy, it was part of the form, and it did really well to make social commentary, as you're saying, but I just personally didn't feel fulfilled, and that's my own individual judgment.
I don't think that the ending was supposed to be fulfilling, but
yeah.
And it was quite loyal to what the book had done, but at the end of the day, I completely understand why you wouldn't like the ending of the movie, but
I just think there's a difference between being ambiguous and being unfinished.
Yeah.
And I feel like this personally felt unfinished, even though, yes, it was too long. They dragged on quite a bit with a few other things, time-wise, like temporally, but in terms of the plot, it didn't feel like it rounded everything up. It didn't feel completed. And while I'm fine with that, usually, it's just, there's a difference between ambiguity and being unfinished. And that's my own personal belief.
So if we have to give this a rating.
Okay, well, yes. For the first film of this massive review podcast, I'm probably going to give Gone Girl a 4.3 out of 5.
That's pretty good.
Yes, it's very high. It's one of my favourite films of the year. Really.
Yeah, look, I thought this movie was incredible. There were small little things that I had a little bit of trouble with, mainly reconciling Neil Patrick Harris's character in my mind while watching this movie.
But well, that's not a flaw with the movie.
No,
it's more of a social.
Yeah. But I'm going to give this 4.7.
Woo! Wow. Is that
okay?
Is that like your second highest score all year, next to X-Men: Days of Future Past?
Probably would be, actually. I really enjoyed Gone Girl, and that's definitely a movie I would see again.
Yeah, I mean, if you guys want recaps of scores that we've given, either go check out our last podcast, or wait till the end of the year when we will give you guys a review, or a 2014 in review recap of our personal favourite films of the year, and generally what 2014 has done well and badly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right, we're reviewing our reviews.
Anyway, so I think we're going to get through these next four reviews pretty quickly.
Very quickly.
Because I feel like they're one as important as Gone Girl, but also as the major one, which we've got at the end of the podcast, Interstellar.
Interstellar.
That's
so,
a talk about.
Yeah, so we're just going to pump through these four films, and you guys can either stay tuned, listen to them all. They're all spoiler-free. Or you guys can check out in the description which times you want to check out, which movie reviews you want to see. So the next film that we're going to talk about is a film that we've all seen, starring Melissa McCarthy and Susan Sarandon, called Tammy. Tammy is a comedy with typical...
yes,
it's a comedy.
It's inverted commas, comedy.
Yeah, I mean, well, they call it a comedy, but we'll get to that. It's about a comedy. It's about a comedy. It's a comedy about Melissa McCarthy's character, Tammy, who is in a really bad stage in her life. She's depressed. She's going through a divorce, going through losing her job and stuff like that. And she's generally a negative character, person. So she's pessimistic, in other words. So her and her grandmother go out and they decide, hey, let's go for a road trip. So they go around, they do some stuff, antics ensue, classic road trip stuff. meet different people, you know, have relationships and whatnot, and then become better people. That's essentially the entire story in a nutshell.
Yeah.
It's hard really to explain the story without giving spoilers.
Well,
without giving this generic exposition of a classic road trip film.
Well, it is the thing that I found interesting about it was because, like, having seen the trailer doesn't give any of the story away. I literally had no idea what the movie was
and
about.
And that's probably a good thing. That's how they got away with, like,
getting
money.
That's how they got people to see the movie.
Because frankly, it doesn't depart from any of the old road trip things. It has a very strict formula and it sticks to it so like glue. It's really doesn't have anything inventive in it.
Looking at the cast as well, like while we were watching the opening credits, I kept seeing names of people that I knew and I started to get more and more excited for the movie. So we've got Melissa McCarthy, Susan Sarandon, Allison Janney, Dan Aykroyd, Kathy Bates, and Sandra Oh, and a whole heap of other people. And I just saw more and more names and I was like, this movie is going to be great.
I think, Next minute,
you realise that the entire... Unfortunately, the entire film seems to have adopted the Adam Sandler style of humour.
Which is essentially
right down the toilet. Yeah.
Which regular listeners to our podcast would know us to be very strong advocators,
We are avid fans of Adam Sandler. Can you notice the sarcasm in my voice? I hope it's not obvious enough.
I think the plethora of cliches just flooding the screen in this film really showcase how much the crew and the creators behind this film really depended entirely on Melissa McCarthy on making this film, because the film is really, really, really generic. I can't stress that enough. Everything they do is so stock standard to a classic road trip film. And yes, road trip films can be done well. Case in point, Due Date, or I mean,
I really like Due Date.
I like
actually.
Due Date, or like not a comedy, Driving Miss Daisy, stuff like that. But comedy road trips are such. It's such a bad formula. I feel like it can be done well. It's just when you're relying solely on one actress who has grounded her her persona to be a really witty, comedic, clever performer. When you really depend on that for an entire film and just flood the rest of fill the gaps with cliches here and there and just absurdity, it doesn't make sense and it doesn't fit well in people's minds who are so used to seeing cleverly done comedies like 21 Jump Street and whatnot.
Or even like the thing that I was really shocked by was that we know that Melissa McCarthy is a funny woman. Like, anybody who's seen the movie The Heat, that's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen in my life.
Or Bridesmaids.
Or Bridesmaids. And so I think that it's really annoying or just upsetting or sad to see Melissa McCarthy, who we know is a really funny woman, in a movie that is just inherently not funny.
Yeah, I think the main issue is that, and I've told you guys this before, is that Melissa McCarthy's characters in the past have been so funny because we can relate to her character. Yeah. Whereas in this film, she plays a pessimistic, rude, arrogant douchebag, I want to say. She doesn't play a character that is relatable or that is sympathetic in any way.
She doesn't play a character that's realistic.
Yeah, she plays this... Well, the only adjective I can think of to describe her character is pathetic.
I mean,
The only thing that I could think of when I was watching this character was like, and I was telling you guys earlier today, was, you know, the idea of when you flip a turtle onto its back and it like moves and it just can't get up. That's all I could think of when I was watching the character of Tammy. Like, she is that turtle who's on her back and just can't get up.
I mean, I had high hopes in the opening scene, and no, this isn't spoilers, but she runs into a deer and she's like, oh no, deer, can you get up, please, buddy, can you get up? And this is like the character that I wanted. This is the Melissa McCarthy that you can relate to. She's funny. She's kind of like, off the cuff humor that is sympathetic, and you get to like this character. That's the kind of thing that I wanted. But then after that scene, she changed completely. Yeah. Like, all of a sudden, she became a rude and just obnoxious person.
Yeah. It's like that one event just pissed her off the entire movie, and she didn't really want to do it anymore.
I mean, mind you, yes, when you lose your job, you go through a divorce, you smash your car, you lose all your money, whatever. Yes, it's a really bad time for you. But in terms of a film, you can't have this character that's so crappy and then not give her this character development that makes her relatable in the end. And yes, while they try to do that in the end, it doesn't make up for this lack of humor. Really just like exploding, like diarrhea from this really unrelatable character's mouth.
Well, the thing that I another thing that I was annoyed by was the fact that there are actually there's some really good actresses in this movie, because it's a very female oriented movie. But we see Allison Janney, who is from The West Wing, who that's a show I absolutely love. It's one of my favorite shows of all time, and she was amazing in that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get Susan Sarandon, who we know is a good actress. She's fantastic. And even Kathy Bates, anybody who's seen the movie Misery or American Horror Story.
Was she in Blindside as well? Yeah, she was Blindside as well.
Yeah.
They are very, very talented actresses. For example, Allison Janney was in two scenes, she doesn't really count.
Even Toni Collette. Toni Collette is one of Australia's pride and joy.
Yeah.
And United States of Tara, which was the show that Toni Collette did for 3 years on Showtime.
Which is great.
And that's one of my, I literally think that's one of the best shows ever made. I love that show. And I saw Toni Collette's name in the opening credits, and I went, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
Next minute, she's only in it for a couple of scenes.
Yeah, two scenes again,
I feel like one of the things this movie did that probably that it did at its detriment was getting a whole heap of really good actors and only giving them a very short amount of screen time.
It makes me feel like it was a big cash grab. Like the names
were
meant to
be.
It all felt like, this is where I feel cheated. I feel cheated like it's just they've taken all these names, they've taken all these people that we like, all these things that we wanted, and they threw them in there, but they didn't do what we want. It was all a lie. They didn't really give us what we wanted with them.
Yeah.
They didn't give us what we expected from those actors and actresses.
I think we can't blame the acting performances here. They did what they could with the characters, and while, they themselves weren't spectacular, it really goes to show how much the writing needed improvement. Because the characters poor. Yeah, exactly.
No actor can salvage that writing.
The characters were poor, the plot line was poor, the dialogue was awful.
Oh, yeah.
And I just feel like it was just a bunch of sketches, little sketches that were seen together and just kind of going, they wrote one scene and then they thought, well, what are we going from here? Just get this sketch that we wrote 10 minutes ago and just mash it onto the end. Just see if that transitions to that. Okay. I just don't feel like it fits seamlessly together, and it wasn't done very well at all.
You get better continuity on Whose Line Is Anyway if
Whose Line Is Anyway. Oh, dude, I love that show.
That's a show that is entirely dependent on improv, so it's it has no script or anything. There's a better storyline to an episode of that show.
Well, there's a show that I love that has... It finished last year, I think, on BBC. It was called Outnumbered. Did you guys ever watch that?
No, I can't
say
I've seen it.
It's one of the funniest shows I've ever seen. And the reason that it was so funny was because it was almost entirely improvised. And
I love that.
It's about a family, two parents and then three kids. And over the years, they kind of grow up. And all of the stuff that the kids, said was unscripted. And, they were prompted, but they weren't given an actual script. And even shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm, which has run for about 8 seasons now, and that's, Larry David, it's a fictional show about his real life that is, he's the creator of Seinfeld, and that is completely unscripted. He
gives prompts.
Also
got Hugh Dennis in it.
Yeah.
I love Hugh Dennis. Hugh Dennis is in Mock the Week and stuff. He's so funny, and he's got this kind of dark humor about him. Go check that out. I'm going to definitely
watch Outnumbered. Is one of my favorite shows. I watched it when we were in year 12. That really got me through the HSC. And Curb Your Enthusiasm, if anybody hasn't seen it, is the ruder, funnier version of Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Which is a big call to make, but Curb Your Enthusiasm's gone for almost, it's 8 years, almost 10 years. And it's almost completely unscripted. It's just prompts.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's a testament to the... just acting ability of some people.
Yeah,
yeah.
Improvisation.
Yeah.
Which is, I bring it back to this film, I feel like that sort of charm was lost.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we know Melissa McCarthy and Susan Sarandon and stuff can do comedic lines, they can do improv, they can embed this sort of relatable kind of cheekiness to their characters that they didn't really employ here.
I don't think they were allowed to, is one of the problems.
Yeah, they were restricted by the script, probably the director and stuff like that, who wanted to follow this strict sort of script. And it didn't pull off for them, really.
It really didn't work out.
Yeah, so while people went to the cinemas expecting a cheeky Melissa McCarthy flick with, you know, witty humor and animated explosions of body movements and whatnot, they're going to leave disappointed, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Griswold Family Vacation, but with more swearing and less Griswolds.
Yeah. So if we're going to give it a rating, what would you guys give it?
I'm going down a 2.
Okay.
Martin's going to give Tammy a 2. Flat. Nice. No decimals. I like it.
Just 2.
Oh, I love my decimals.
I know. I can't say I like it.
I'm giving it 0.5.
0.5. Okay. Tammy, for me, once again, was a shocking attempt at a comedy. And I'm not blaming the actresses or the actors for this. They did what they could with the characters they were given. And it was just poor writing, poor filming, and it gets a 0.8 from me.
Solid. Well, the only thing I can say about Tommy really is that it's like The Hangover 3 on steroids, if the steroids made it worse.
It's like The Hangover 2 as well. Like The Hangover, that's a whole other story. The Hangover series is really one continuum.
Well,
the same movie 3 times.
Yeah, well, I saw The Hangover 3 the other day, actually.
Oh,
and
oh, you shouldn't have done that.
Like an hour and a half of my life, I just can't get back.
Yeah, that's The Hangover series. Number one was good. I'm going like, just a
but
this is an impromptu movie review here, guys. Like number one was okay. It was funny for the time because we hadn't seen that. But then number 2 and 3 just did it all over again, and we kind of lost it.
I think because number one, it really depended on the sort of randomness of the actual film. Just like, oh, where the hell is it going now? By the second one, and they start to rehash old plots. It's like, oh, getting a bit old, getting a bit too predictable, and that's kind of sad. Sorry.
Yeah.
Moving on to the third film.
Yes.
So I saw David Ayer's new flick recently, Fury, starring Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf. What's his name? His name's John Bernthal from Walking Dead. People know him as Shane and Logan Lerman.
No,
so
sorry, just before we can start, I've got to ask.
Yes, Percy Jackson.
I've got to ask. How many times did Shia LaBeouf say "whoa" in this film?
Whoa! I actually can't remember because honestly, I was quite blown away from this film. And yes, Shia LaBeouf's acting performance. Fury takes place in the midst of World War II, wherein a little squadron of 4 or 5 people, played by the actors I've just said, run a tank called Fury. And Fury is like trying to go through Nazi Germany and trying to take over towns, trying to like relieve prisoners of war and whatnot. It's essentially just a tank trying to kill Nazis. And yes, it's a simple premise, but boy, is it done well. I mean, let's start off with the acting. The acting in this movie was incredible. Brad Pitt himself was quite outstanding. Not obviously Oscar-worthy, but he was pretty good. Shia LaBeouf has come out of nowhere to actually knock this out of the park. While he wasn't a major character, he did very well with what he was given. And he portrayed this kind of emotional character really, really well. Logan Lerman himself, as you guys may remember, was Percy Jackson in Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which I felt was a very disappointing portrayal of what's his name, Riordan's book series.
Yeah.
Rick Riordan, I think. Yeah. And so I was kind of worried and nervous about Logan Lerman playing in this. However, I was quite blown away by this film. The tone itself was outstanding. It is really dark, kind of gory, but gritty in a way. It was very Saving Private Ryan, I guess. The entire way through the film, I thought of Saving Private Ryan because it was so real and so unapologetic is the word I feel. It's very, it's kind of a Tarantino-esque in the way that it just portrays violence and characters in such a way that it's unapologetic, and it just puts them on screen and says, look, you can deal with it however you want, but this is the truth, this is what actually happened, this is what people have actually dealt with before. And I think the main case in point of this is the main cast, which is a series of characters that are kind of unlikable, or dislikable, I should say. And a lot of criticism of the movie has come from these characters that you really, really want to like, but you can't, just at the end, they're just out of reach of your likability. While, yes, 2 or 3 of them have, like, do end up becoming relatable, just John Bernthal's character in particular becomes such a douchebag or such an unnecessarily cruel character that it's really hard to like these characters and to support them when they're in the midst of this battle against the Nazis and this horde of Germans just trying to take over the tank or trying to pass and they're stuck in the middle of the road and they're trying to hold down the fort. But, however, I would disagree with these criticisms. I feel like to the layperson, then yes, maybe these characters would be unlikable. But to movie reviewers like us, we can catch up on the little subtleties of the film that they embed that kind of override the cruelty imposed by these characters on Logan Lerman and on Brad Pitt. And while they're douchebags, there's just these small moments in the film that are easily missed and that are easily overlooked that not make up for it, but just make these characters relatable enough so that you can support them in the end. And I feel like the criticisms that people have actually given this film are kind of unfounded in a way. But moving on from that, I feel like the tone of the film was incredible. It was gritty. It was really, really well designed. The sets themselves were, while yes, obviously sets, they were really, really well done. The costumes were so, so well designed. And the film itself was just a really, really realistic, really intriguing, harkening back to the gritty depths of World War II and the experiences of American soldiers and most soldiers in general, where people die and people get hurt, not only by the enemy, but by themselves. And it's really interesting to watch this film. I highly recommend it for everyone. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. And just the final battle scene, it was really something special. So definitely check it out. Fury, I'm going to give a 4.3 again out of 5.
That's 4.3 very
out of
5. Solid.
Yes, I think that this movie was tied with Gone Girl for sure. Wow. This year. Yeah.
86% HD.
Gets an HD, just passing the HD. Yes. Whoa. So yeah, I really enjoyed Fury. Obviously, I'm probably a little bit more positive than a lot of other critics who have given it a lower rating. Like, it's got about an 8 on IMDb out of 10. Which is, again, only 80%, but it's only 6% off. But just the criticisms that people give this film, I feel like, yes, again, to the layperson who is very unknowledgeable in films, they overlook the subtleties of it and they don't recognize that these characters are actually quite layered and are far more layered than they expected them to be. So definitely go check it out and don't go in it with a very one-dimensional mindset. Be open to a whole different, a plethora of emotions. And it's a full-on experience, I give you that much. So yeah, Fury, go check that one out. In cinemas still, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
So, despite the fact that Halloween has passed, Rohan saw the newest and probably most conflicting flick in terms of critics' receptions of it, because there have been
mixed reviews
on very different ends of the spectrum. I've heard people have loved it, heard people hated it. The movie itself, if you haven't already guessed, is Annabelle.
Nope.
I want Martin and I are going to close our ears for this little segment while Rohan does it, because he saw the film recently or before.
Well,
Halloween,
yeah, I saw it on the day that it came out.
Okay, well, not recently. No. As if you guys listen to episode 8, Martin and I hate horror movies, so we're just gonna let Rohan take this one, and I'm gonna listen to happy music go into my quiet place.
I am thinking of thoughts.
Well, like, if you guys didn't know already, Annabelle is the sequel, or well, actually prequel, to the movie The Conjuring, which is regarded as one of the greatest horror movies of all time, really. They only came out a couple of years ago. But Annabelle is the story of a doll that appears in the movie The Conjuring, and how that doll kind of came to be supernatural and haunted and all of that kind of stuff without giving it too much away. But the movie is set in the 1950s, where The Conjuring is set in the 70s. And it follows characters that aren't in the original Conjuring. So if you watch The Conjuring and you're expecting those characters to be in Annabelle, you're going to be a little bit disappointed. But at the end of the day, look, before saying anything else, Annabelle, in my opinion, is one of the best horror movies I've seen in a very long time.
Better than Conjuring?
I don't know if I want to say it's better than The Conjuring, but I definitely say that it is very, very good. Annabelle is just a very interesting, very dark movie. And I would say that the first 10 minutes of the movie itself, I would give those 10 minutes 10 out of 10.
Wow.
The scares in that movie are just... just in those 10 minutes are so great. It is so intense and very, very, like, just tense in general. I was on the edge of my seat for just that whole 10 minutes.
Are the scares well done, though? Are they jump scares?
Yes. No, they are very well done. Okay. There's this one scene, and I think it's in the trailer, and you'll know what I mean when you see the movie. You'll know that one scene in the first 10 minutes that is just absolutely great. And I saw it with about... must have been about 6 people, and there were people who were just screaming in the cinema when it happened. And you know that a horror movie is good when it, like, you get screams in the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several instances in the movie when that happened. The movie I thought was great, but it had a few shortcomings, and especially towards the end, the use of the supernatural in the movie became a little bit excessive. There were things definitely that the movie should have focused on, and there were things that the movie should not have focused on. And the movie deals with things like possession and demons and just mentally ill, crazy people. And I think that the movie would have done better dealing with the crazy people rather than dealing with the actual demons. Because towards the end of the movie, it kind of went to a specific place where I became quite bored with what they were doing, and it became a lot less scary. And so the movie started out terrifying and kind of ended very meh.
Hmm.
And the ending is definitely one of the more unsatisfying horror movie endings I've seen.
So did they spend too much time explaining the actual thing that was scary?
I think that the movie would have been scarier if they focused on what they focused on in the beginning of the movie, which is... I don't know how much I want to give away, but it's the beginning of the movie focuses on Annabelle, who is an actual girl. And if they'd spent the movie focusing on Annabelle as a villain instead of, like, a demon as a villain... I mean, it's a horror movie. There really aren't that many spoilers.
Mm.
But if they'd focused on Annabelle instead of the demon, the movie would have been a lot less scarier, because as a villain... the demon was not scary at all.
Okay.
It was very generic.
Is a very typical villain archetype.
Yeah.
It's a very well done.
But even, like, the people that I saw this with are, you know, very knowledgeable about, like, supernatural stuff and the way that this works potentially in the real world. And every single person that I've talked to about this movie has said that the movie would have been scarier if they had focused less on the demon. And... I mean, the movie The Conjuring, in itself, anybody who's seen The Conjuring knows the kind of stuff that that deals with, the supernatural phenomenon that deals with. And I just found what was happening with the Annabelle doll in that, towards the end of the movie, to be quite lackluster. It built up and built up and built up, and it didn't really go anywhere. And so my main criticism of the movie is just, it's a story criticism. They shouldn't have picked the villain that they picked. Instead of kind of changing track halfway through the movie, they should have stuck with what they were originally going with.
Okay.
And so, whilst Annabelle is one of the scarier movies that I've seen, I think you can kind of apply what I like to call the American Horror Story principle, where anybody who's seen American Horror Story, it's one of my favorite TV shows to date. I love it, and I'm keeping up to date with the newest season religiously. But the show has a trend where it gets really good and then halfway through gets very average, and the endings are very unsatisfying. You can apply a very similar principle to Annabelle, where it starts off incredibly, and that first 10 minutes is outstanding. And then as the movie progresses, it gets more and more average, to the point where you can pretty much predict what happens at the end.
I think it's dangerous to have a horror movie prequel.
Yeah.
And sequel as well, but mostly prequel, because you essentially know that the villain is going to still be around at the end.
Mm.
And so, like, the ending is predictable in a way. So it's dangerous to go into it and to set yourself up for this sort of film where the ending is again, predictable.
Yeah.
But you need to still have these twists and turns where you don't know where it's going to go.
See, sometimes horror movie sequels work out fairly well. Like, I'm quite a fan of Scream 4, where there was a lot of fan service in that movie, and it treated the Scream series, which had been very badly treated in Scream 2 and Scream 3, in a quite a good way. But and even the Insidious movies, I didn't find the second one terrible. It wasn't great, but it wasn't as good as the first one, but it was okay. But I mean, when you make a horror movie sequel or a prequel, you verge on in that area of making it like Friday the 13th and Halloween, where it gets really cheesy,
yeah,
and like gratuitous violence, even in the Saw franchises where that happens.
I mean, to the point where it essentially loses its touch of horror,
yeah,
and becomes a comedy. Like,
yeah,
Freddy Krueger became a comedic villain,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Or even like Chucky,
Child's Play,
yeah, Child's Play, yeah, where it started off being a horror series and then transferred into dark comedy. So I think that my main criticism of Annabelle, and the reason that I wouldn't give it like a D or HD mark, is just because their planning of the movie, they underestimated what people would find scary and what people wouldn't find scary. And so if I was going to give Annabelle a rating, I would give it a solid credit. I'd give it 3.5.
Okay.
It's a solid mark.
Solid mark.
I would probably see Annabelle, like, in a couple of years, I would probably see Annabelle again. I'd do what I did before I saw the movie and have a double feature, watch The Conjuring,
yeah,
and then go see Annabelle. But I don't think that it's... I just was very kind of annoyed and frustrated that they ended it the way they did and they took that kind of track.
Like, having not seen it, I can't really explain what I think is missing from the movie, but I do. It does, like, from your description, it feels like there was a lot of build up in Annabelle,
yeah,
right? But there wasn't any release. It was. It feels like a big principle in horror movies is this tension and release. And without the release, the tension builds to a point where it's unrealistic, and you just go no,
yeah,
and you lose the investment. Your investment and in the movie, and you just like it becomes something that's
becomes attached from
it. Yeah,
yeah, you can attach. It doesn't become scary anymore.
Anybody who, like, Annabelle is based on a true story. Like, The Conjuring is based on a true story. It's based on a doll that Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are real people who are still alive, keep locked in their basement. And completely true, they have it blessed by a priest once every couple of weeks to keep the demon from getting out, but that doll in and of itself, if you go and see a picture of the Annabelle doll, is terrifying. But I just wish that they'd focused on the doll rather than the demon possessing.
It's frustrating,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There
but,
was a lot of potential.
Yeah. So what would you rate this film out of 5?
Yeah, about
5. We already said this. Oh, sorry, I've just completely lost track. I'm just too excited to get to Interstellar, really.
Yes.
Which is why
me
I'm
going
to rush through the next film review. So, Boyhood is a film by Richard Linklater, which was incredible because it spanned like 10 or 12 years. Where they filmed different scenes like once every couple of months. So, as the characters grew, the actors also grew. So that essentially the same actor played the same character since when they were 7 to when they were 20. And it's really incredible the way he actually made this film. It follows a boy called Mason and his mum and his sister, who are embroiled in several different divorces, and just watching them grow up, go through the trials and tribulations of teenage life, and dealing with their mum having so many different failed relationships and different father figures, while also Ethan Hawke, their actual father, being there and trying his best to redeem himself and become a good father. And I thought this film was really, really ballsy. It's such a big move to say, hey, I'm going to make a film over 12 years using the same actors since like 2002. And I thought it was really, really well done in that sense, because every time period that they went to, they really harkened back to our own personal experiences of that time period. So, like, you had when they were, like, back in the early 2000s, they had Britney playing and they had different cartoons there and, like, lots of Dragon Ball Z references and stuff like that. And and as it went on... Oh, no, this was in 2002. This is, like, 2000. Then it went to 2001, where you had, like, 9/11 and references there to Iraq and political references, like who was going to be voted in, whether George Bush should be voted in, blah, blah, blah. And it was really, really well done. The way that they didn't, you know, sort of ignore the context of the situation, just focus on the characters. They actually involved the world around them. And it really made it seem like the script itself was adaptable, because the character of Ethan Hawke particularly, he was really involved in the different social and political climates of each era. And I felt like it was really well done, the way that they could adapt this and transition so well between the years and the different zeitgeists, I guess. And it was done very well. And I think that Linklater made some really great directorial decisions in terms of the way it should be shot. The camera angles are really unique. The different close-ups of each of the characters, as well as the panning shots. Some of the casting choices weren't great. I felt like... They risked it a lot in casting a lot of actors and actresses who were not very well known, purely because they could commit to this sort of project over the span of a decade or so. Yes, they had Ethan Hawke and they had Patricia Arquette, who was from Medium and Holes. They played the mother and the father. Yes, they were quite well known, and they must have thought that Patricia Arquette would have become someone even bigger back then, because at the time
she was huge.
She was huge in Medium, but obviously, you know, just didn't work out for her in the end. But I really like who they did cast for the most part. However, Linklater did like delve into his own personal bank, and he got his daughter to actually play the sister of Mason, the main character, who was herself quite an important role, but just, boy, was she a shocking actress. I don't mean to be offensive, but it just happens. I mean, like, she's not great in this film. And yes, she was young when she first started. She hasn't gotten that sort of training. But it was kind of a bit too indulgent, I guess, for Linklater to cast his daughter in it when she hasn't had that sort of experience or, need I say it, talent.
I think in fields like this, nepotism is really not a good thing to have.
Yeah, I think
it really doesn't have a place.
Maybe he was just trying to look for security in thinking, hey, my daughter, I'm going to be attached to her for at least the next 10 to 12 years. May as well just cast her in it, keep her going, so that I have this security there in her being there for the entire project. However, yes, as you say, nepotism is dangerous, and it didn't really work out with her there. However, the story itself has gotten complaints, because there have been a lot of criticisms in the plot not having a climax. There's no orientation, there's no conflict, there's no resolution or anything, and it's really hard for a lot of critics to say that it's a good film when there isn't that sort of stock standard A-B plot with,
yeah,
you know, this happens and this happens and this happens, then it's finally resolved. And I actually disagree with those sorts of criticisms. I think it's really important to show this progression of children's and adults' lives, and showing this family changing and moving and adapting to different situations, to different contexts. And each little time period has its own issue, and it translates to the next time period. And it all just like flows as though we are watching this boy grow up, and we are watching this boy go through, insert title here, Boyhood. And it's really interesting, and it's something that hasn't been done before. It's ballsy, as I said, to actually approach this and to even contemplate doing this. And as we'll talk about later in our review of Interstellar, directors who make these sorts of gutsy moves should be applauded. And in this movie, that was done really, really well. And so this film it makes you feel good. It's a feel good film, and yes, there are different elements to it that are difficult to swallow, and there are elements that aren't really fulfilling in a way, but while there are these flaws, the essential component of this film, filmed over 10 years, 12 years, whatever, it has been done very well, very well. And maybe it'll get an Oscar nod just in nomination, just like to congratulate it on the work that it's done, on the effort that it's put in. But I don't think it will, personally, just because it's not as good it's not good enough a film to be nominated for Best Picture. But I think Linklater and the actors and the actresses all need to be applauded for what they've done. And the film itself, I will give a 3.4 out of 5. So it's a feel-good film. Check it out, if anything, just because you want to see how these actors progress from year to year. And yeah, really enjoyable film.
Cool.
Yeah,
okay. All right, well, we're going to take a little break now, but when we come back, we are going to have an amazing review of Interstellar.
I don't want you to get a mistake about something else. I want to get to know you. Tell me, where you from and what you doing most of all, what's your name? She said Jillian and I said drive, Jillian
Welcome back to the Fiction Fix. We are going to continue our review of
Interstellar.
Woo! Oh my god!
Sorry, my voice just went really high pitched then because we literally just walked out. We walked out of the cinema a couple of hours ago, and we've let ourselves calm down, kind of like relax a bit, so we can get into the zone.
We did that. Oh,
well,
shit.
Rohan and I were able to. Sorry, Martin's still a little bit jittery.
Martin still literally can't even. So, Interstellar.
Woo! Yeah, I mean, like, I just, every time we mention the name Interstellar, I just go, woo! Because I get so excited about it. In the few months that were leading up to it, in fact, in the 12 months that were leading up to it, ever since we found out that Christopher Nolan was helming this exercise, or this project, I got super excited about it. My voice just went really high-pitched. And Christopher Nolan is my personal favorite director of all time, because all his films I have loved to death. I mean, just take Dark Knight. Dark Knight is one of, I believe, one of the greatest films of all time. It is almost perfect.
I would second that.
Yes, would you agree?
I love The Dark Knight.
And I think we can all agree that Christopher Nolan has really, really shown himself to be quite a fantastic director. I mean, just in his style, in his storytelling, in his characters, in just this way he's able to translate scripts and screenplays onto the big screen. It's been phenomenal. And he takes on these huge tasks. I mean, when we first found out about Interstellar, if you listen back to our earlier podcasts, we were kind of worried and nervous for him in that the trailers showed that there was going to be so much going on in this plot.
Yeah.
And the only real, like, solace we found in, like, him being able to put that such a big vision onto the screen is that A, it was going to be 3 hours long, and B, it was Christopher Nolan. If anyone could do this, it was going to be Christopher Nolan. So, got me super pumped up for it.
Well, see, the thing that I was a little bit apprehensive about was this movie had kind of come off the back of Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was worried about in both Gravity and again in Interstellar over a year later was this idea that there would not be that much, like, happening in terms of plot. I didn't know what they were going to do because
just be visual overload?
Yeah, exactly. I thought that it was just going to be very kind of gratuitous special effects and stuff like that.
Let's show off our special effects engines.
Yeah.
Like, let's give the special effects team a job for once
and
everyone else can, like, yeah.
Exactly.
And I think that's where... Sorry to interrupt. I think that's where Gravity and this film differ.
In that, Gravity
is... It has incredible special effects. It's phenomenal the way Alfonso Cuarón and the art directors were able to implement their cinematography and their special effects into that film. But the plot itself was really simplistic.
Very, very, very simple. Not much happens in terms of plot.
However,
Interstellar.
Oh my god. Complete contrast. Yes, the effects are incredible. Obviously, I don't think as incredible as Gravity, purely because of the clarity of Gravity. But the effects in this were still super, super impressive. And I will definitely be nominated for an Oscar for best effects and probably best cinematography as well.
Yeah.
But the plot was so complex, so detailed.
Very, very, very detailed. And, I mean, we can only tell you so much because we want to avoid as many spoilers as is physically possible. And
that's what it rides on.
Yeah, and the plot of this movie is...
Before everything else. Big spoiler, guys. It's in space. Oh, shit.
Ruined it for everyone, Martin. Really?
Yeah. This is why we can't have nice things.
Sorry.
But yeah.
All right, sorry. Continue on, Ryan.
So, I mean, this movie doesn't entirely, like, hinge on the special effects. It actually is very deeply rooted in the story.
And the characters.
Yeah.
My God, the relationship between these characters is really what drives this film. Where Gravity was like, oh my God, stars, space,
Sandra Bullock.
Flying effects. Yeah, Sandra Bullock. Whoa. It was just Sandra Bullock in the middle of this vast space. And that's what really drove the film. Whereas in this movie, the special effects were there and they were incredible. However, it's Matthew McConaughey, his plot and his character development, as well as his relationship with his daughter, that really, really drove this film.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly well done. And again, we don't want to go into too much detail about spoilers and whatnot, because what this film has really advertised itself off was just being this trailer that shows space and, you know, words and smoke and fire and stuff, but there's really no explanation, no description of what the plot will actually be. So I think it's really part of the experience to go in there without knowing too much about the plot. So we won't go into too much detail in that respect. It really drives off the character played by Matthew McConaughey of Cooper, and he is an engineer. Who's now working a farm and whatever, and all of a sudden, through twists and turns, he's piloting a spacecraft out to space. That's the general plot, in search of, like, planets or whatever.
Yeah, and it's set in a kind of a very realistic, I felt,
dystopian.
Sort of dystopian future.
Not even dystopian, just future.
Yeah.
Or the Stark future, sorry. Dystopian's not the right word.
Very realistic. Yeah. Like, I feel like they went to kind of very appropriate lengths to make this movie, and this is something we'll definitely talk about later, but to make this movie as realistic as is physically possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But something that I really liked about this movie was just the fact, like, as I said 5 seconds ago, that the plot is so great. And it's one of those things, not going into a movie knowing pretty much, you know, nothing about it. Like, I think that this movie is best seen not knowing anything about
Absolutely.
It, which is why
I
think that it's important we don't kind of tell you guys everything in the plot, because there are a lot of amazing twists in this movie that I did not see coming.
Yeah.
That I just absolutely... I had moments where I just freaked out in the middle of the cinema. And I think that this movie is definitely best seen when you don't know anything about what's happening.
Yeah, with an absence of information. I think, because Rohan and I and Martin, we all sat in the cinema, and every time a twist happened or a character came up that we didn't expect, we would turn to each other and go, oh my God, and just throw our hands at the screen.
So I would definitely suggest don't go on Wikipedia, don't go on IMDb, don't go on anything before you see the movie, because it's so much better seeing it without any knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like Martin said, see it blind. Metaphorically see it blind.
Yes.
Don't see it actually blind.
Just actually see it blind, please
watch it.
Yeah, because the effects are incredible. But if we're going to start off talking about it, let's talk about this relationship between Matthew McConaughey and his daughter.
Yeah.
Cooper and Murph. It's this real dynamic there between father and daughter that has been played and has been tried and tested. It's been done before in loads of movies, but this film just does something completely different.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is that they do that's different, but it's just done so well with such complexity and such incredible acting.
Yeah, I think that we need to give Matthew McConaughey just, like, this McConaissance or whatever we're calling it now. He's really made a comeback. Like, we thought that Dallas Buyers Club and True Detective would be the peak, but honestly, Interstellar, it's not overshadowed by either of those two things.
Oh, his work in this movie is phenomenal.
It is amazing.
I mean, you've seen the scene in the trailer where him and Murph, his daughter, are crying on the bed, but there's also another scene right at the end where he gets super emotional. There's another scene in the middle where he's watching different videos, and he's getting really, really intensely into this character.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible watching this man who we've previously seen in 10 Things I Had... Oh, not 10 Things I Had About You. In How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, in Fool's Gold, Sahara, most of which were flops. But it's so incredible to watch him now and to see how much he's progressed, to see how much he's developed as an actor and as a person, because he is apparently a great guy. But his acting style is truly, truly inspirational. It's amazing. He involves himself so much into these characters, and he invests himself into every scene, to every emotion. And it's really something to walk out of the cinema thinking, wow,
Yeah.
That man is a great actor, which is not something that I would have thought back in the early 2000s.
No, definitely not. Mm. But he made those characters real. He made that relationship, the relationship between Cooper and Murph, he made that so real. And you could feel, like, the emotion that both of those characters were feeling throughout the entire 3 hours of the movie. And I think that it's a feat, considering the movie was one of the longest movies I've ever seen. And I'm Indian, right? We have all these movies that go for, like, 4 hours. That's one of the longest movies I've ever seen, but it didn't feel that long. And to sustain a relationship for the entire duration of that movie is, like, a massive feat. And I think that, you know, props to them for being able to do that.
Yeah, I think we should also give props to Mackenzie Foy, who plays young Murph, who, for a child actress around 10 or 11 or something, she's actually really good. Mm. She portrays emotion and she portrays character really, really well. And she suited this role to a T. Her and McConaughey have this just this dynamic working between them, bouncing back and forth, that works so well and makes their relationship incredibly believable. And it's great. The casting choices were phenomenal.
Yeah.
I can't say that enough. That, in fact, that's probably my word to describe this film in every little aspect. It's just phenomenal. It's mind-blowing how well it was done. It's
absolutely.
It's the detail. Absolutely. The detail of everything, whether it's the research, whether it's the detail in the special effects, the detail in the acting, that's what it's all about. And that's what makes a great film. That's what characterizes Christopher Nolan's film, is the detail and the effort he puts into everything. And it's really something special.
Can we talk about Anne Hathaway for a second?
Please, go ahead.
Anne Hathaway plays a scientist whose name is Dr. Brand, Amelia Brand. And you would have seen that she's in the movie from the trailer. She comes in around, you know, closer to towards the end of the first third of the movie. But she is just outstanding in this movie. She was amazing.
I mean, yeah.
Don't expect anything less from Anne Hathaway, but still, when I see her in this movie, I was just taken aback at how good she was.
I mean, yeah, she was meant to be sort of emotionless at the beginning.
Mm.
And mind you, she was kind of like, I wouldn't say overpowered, but she was in the shadow a bit in Matthew McConaughey's shadow. Throughout the film, I think Matthew McConaughey really stepped up in this one again.
Mm.
But it draws away from Anne Hathaway's really great performance, and people haven't focused on that as yet. Like, critics haven't really looked into Anne Hathaway's performance as much, but I think credit where credit's due. Anne Hathaway played the character incredibly well, with really great emotion and power. Mm. And for a character that has, I wouldn't say lack of depth, but a character that has less depth than McConaughey, although still has that sort of history there, she really, really stepped up to the plate. And she's done super well. But also, Michael Caine was in the film playing her father, who was kind of a little bit more absent in the film than I expected him to be. However, his scenes that he was in were also very well done. I mean, Michael Caine is no stranger to Christopher Nolan's films. He's been in Inception, the Dark Knight series, and so we know what to expect with that partnership. But really, I haven't seen that sort of emotion from him in past Nolan films.
Yeah, and anybody who's seen the film knows that there's one scene towards the end of the second third of the movie that his acting is so powerful. He is a very powerful actor.
Yeah.
The emotion that he invests into his performances, I'm just constantly surprised at the talent that Hollywood can produce sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, every single actor and actress in this film did phenomenally well, whether it be Jessica Chastain or a surprise actor who we will not mention, but boy, are there spoilers in there.
But I literally think that the casting in this movie was almost flawless.
Yeah.
It really was. It was flawless. I can't think of a single character in that movie that I went, I don't like you.
Not even just actors. Yeah, the characters themselves. Yeah, they were outstanding. And every single one of them was essential to the plot in some way.
And layered.
Yeah, I didn't feel like any actor was miscast. I didn't feel like any actor was replaceable at all. I felt like every single actor really made the characters their own and really, really became them. As though they thought to themselves, you know what? I became an actor for a reason, and I'm I need to invest myself in these characters.
Yeah, and I think that that definitely happened.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even the guy who was it?
Tom.
Even the guy that played, like, Doyle and Romilly, the other guys who are on the ship with them, they even stepped up to the plate. Where they were needed.
Yeah.
And so acting was phenomenal. The tone itself throughout the film, it was really crisp.
Yeah.
Kind of dark.
It was a very tense movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first third or so was a little bit slow, I think. But it started to pick up. It definitely picked up and like from the kind of end of the first third of the film, because the film can kind of be broken up into three different sections.
Yeah, for sure.
Towards the end of the first third of the film, it really just started to pick up, and the pacing became like quite rapid. It increased towards the end, and it was just very, very tense. I was on the edge of my seat for most of the film.
I feel like it picked up where it needed to pick up.
Yeah,
it slowed down where it needed to slow down. Yeah. I think the first act, while some may criticize it for being too slow, I feel like
I don't think it was too slow.
I don't think it was too slow at all. I think the people who criticize it for being too slow were obviously just pretty impatient to get to space.
Yeah.
So I think the first act was really where the characters were built up.
Yeah.
But that's not where it stopped either, which is really important, is that in this sort of film, you can't just have a build-up of character in the first act and then boom, action, then boom, explosion, whatever. This film has constant character progression throughout the entire film. Yeah. There's this arc for every single character, and you can track the moment that the arc begins and the arc ends.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's just so well-rounded, the characters and the plot. And it's really something that Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan do so well when they come together and they make a film like this.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about it like now, and you're absolutely right in saying that every single character's development is important to the movie. Because I was, like, thinking to myself, literally 5 seconds ago, I thought to myself, Matthew McConaughey's character, his development was very, very important and very interesting and complex. And then I thought to myself, okay, yeah, but Anne Hathaway's was as well. And then so was Doyle's, and so was Murph's.
So was Michael Caine's.
Yeah, so was Tom's.
Yeah.
Like, literally every single character goes through something very, very complex and very dark and you know, transformative.
But very real at the same
time. Everything that happens to the characters is real, and the emotion they feel is emotion that transfers onto the audience. That kind of pathos, that relationship is done so phenomenally in this movie.
Yeah, I think there's a ripple effect from these characters and the conflicts that they all go through and the arcs that they all take. There's a ripple effect not only for us as an audience, but also for the other characters that impacts them, impacts their arc. And
definitely.
And it just adds so much more complexity to the movie.
And
that's one thing that I'll say about Jonathan Nolan's and also Christopher Nolan's writing, is that they create these characters and these complex plots that seem so impossible to tie together seamlessly. But they just, in this film and in The Dark Knight, they just showcase how brilliant they are at writing for screen and writing characters and writing plots, and it's just, it's really, really something special.
Absolutely.
And it's that's why I love Christopher Nolan so much, and it's why I love Jonathan Nolan so much as well. It's because they can do this, they can defy the impossible and create these visions that everyone else, you know, everyone else kind of finds it hard to believe that they can actually put on the screen, because it's just too big of a bite. It's too big of a bite to chew.
And this film definitely had an exorbitant amount of potential to turn out like that.
Absolutely.
It really could, because the movie is, for all intents and purposes, an epic. And as with any other epic, there is so much going on that there is just the endless potential for it to turn out to be a disaster and go on a tangent.
Train wreck.
Yeah.
Or get caught up in clichés that are very it's a representative of this genre space.
Well, let's
epics and science fiction genres.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the genre actually, because I think that is something that's really important to why this film is so like just amazing.
I mean, they all thought that Interstellar was going to become the new 2001: A Space Odyssey, which kind of gave it too much hype for people to go into it, and then a lot of people came out like disappointed that it wasn't going to be that. But I would have to disagree, because 2001: A Space Odyssey and Interstellar are two genres, well, they, or yeah, subgenres.
They deal with different things.
Yeah, I mean, you can't expect this to be a new 2001 Space Odyssey, because Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan aren't going in there with the mindset that they want to replace it, or they want to become the new 2001 Space Odyssey.
I don't think Christopher Nolan has any, like, idea in his mind, like, I want to be Stanley Kubrick.
No, because Christopher Nolan is his own person, and he's established that so clearly, whether it be Inception or Memento, he has shown himself to be a director and a visionary that wants to put his mark on the world and not repeat someone else's, not repeat Stanley Kubrick's, not repeat anyone else's. I mean, Dark Knight showed that.
Yeah.
He really, his entire resume of works has showcased that. And I don't know why people went into it expecting that it would be like 2001 A Space Odyssey, whether it be, you know, the trying to replicate the impact of it, or trying to replicate the genre or the style or the commentary.
Yeah.
It didn't go into that with that intention, and I think it's wrong to come out of it disappointed that it didn't achieve that.
Well, one thing that really did it for me within this movie was just the way that they researched the science behind what was happening.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Because, like, without going into too much detail, the film deals very heavily with space travel and with the sciences of climate change. And
even that wasn't, like, shoved down your throat.
It wasn't shoved down your throat. And yeah, everything that happened had a very heavy scientific and mathematical framework behind it. And from what I understand, everything was researched very thoroughly.
I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson has had a few, as we know, is a very well-known scientist and moviegoer. And he's had a few interviews where he has actually praised the scientifics and the details of this film in a higher degree than he did to Gravity, and he gave Gravity a lot of praise for it. And while he said that this had flaws in some respects, he really, really gave Interstellar his seal of approval in terms of scientific accuracy.
Yeah, well, I think the topics that Interstellar deals with are very, very different from Gravity. Gravity is very centered around what happens around Earth. And yes. So it deals on space in a smaller scale, a far smaller scale.
Yes.
The scope of what's explored in Interstellar is exponentially larger than what's explored in Gravity. And so they have a lot more room to kind of make mistakes or to incorporate a lot more science. And so what I really like about Interstellar is the fact that they had a lot more to kind of research. They had a lot more work to do in getting this film to be as accurate as is physically possible, and they did it.
And they didn't just throw words at us that sounded scientific, like jargon or anything, and then expect us to believe it. They actually went into so much detail in their research, and it's so obvious, because everything they say is just completely realistic, and it's fathomable in real life, because as you say, Rohan, they went out of their way to explore notions that gravity didn't even dare to explore. They explored stuff like time, space, wormholes, whatnot. They go into all this sort of detail about phenomenon that we can't even explain. Like, even nowadays, science itself is still struggling to explain it, but they go into so much research about it that they've probably seemingly come up with an answer that to us doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
Which is, like, incredible when a movie that is fictitious can make you believe that there is a real answer out there, and it's not just some fictitious story element that they've added or that they've created out of thin air.
Well, anybody with even a rudimentary kind of understanding of science will go into this movie and get something out of what they're saying. And I think for us, like, we're high school graduates, we have done, like, 10 years of science.
Yeah.
11 for some. And like, or 12 for some. And like, going and having that kind of background, I really felt like I got a lot out of this, just in terms of like understanding the plot, even as simple as that.
For sure. Let's talk about the special effects, because my God, is this going to be nominated for Oscar? Absolutely.
It will be.
If it's not, I would be ashamed to call myself a movie critic.
I 90%, 99% reckon this will be nominated for an Oscar.
If it's not, there is
something seriously wrong.
Yeah, they're pulling another Dark Knight 2009.
Yeah, this is another area where just the accuracy of the science really is reflected in their ability to express it. Because they haven't just explained it, they've shown it to us in a way that is, like, that looks realistic.
Yeah,
in a way
absolutely.
That seems, like, entirely possible.
Just the one... The three words really, like, captivated for me is bending of light.
Yeah.
It's... Their use of light and the way they contort it and bend it and make... change it into different shapes in this massive void of darkness. It's... really something to behold. It's yeah. so incredible. And the visionaries, the vision behind this film made it seem like it would be impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, as we said before, gravity keeps it contained within a small sphere where they look out at stars and galaxies from afar. This goes into detail. This takes you up close and personal with places and locations out there in the stars that we never thought we'd be able to see. And yeah. it takes us there. It takes us as an audience on the journey to these places so we can witness firsthand what it really looks like. And it's really done so well.
I mean, the landscapes in this movie alone are absolutely, absolutely amazing. They're beautiful. And I'm not even just talking about the space landscapes as well. There's a lot of natural landscapes in the movie as well. Mm, yeah. And all of those are just outstanding. But what I want to draw attention to is there are so many different aspects of space that the movie explores. I mean, apart from like stars and planets and like they have wormholes and black holes and the visuals of those things, like the wormhole is one thing that like just the visual of that wormhole
yeah.
was so interesting. And there was a scientific background for the way that they did it as well. There was some sort of creative imaginary vision that was just inspired when coming up with those things.
It's interesting that you guys bring that up because as Martin said before, their designs of these actual places were not just, you know, something to aesthetic to put up on the screen. They're actually grounded in scientific fact because yeah. they provide a scientific explanation for every single thing and why the designs are exactly this way, how they function, how it could benefit the characters, how it could detriment the characters. Really, everything is explained, and it's that detail that really makes this film.
The film has taken these concepts and they've completely formed them to be the scientific thing. They're not some visual representation, as you were saying. So we can actually get a real actual sense of knowledge. We actually get real knowledge from these things, as opposed to watching things like 2001: Space Odyssey or Planet of the Apes or anything like that, any of the other science fiction genre, which do take liberties for the creative purposes.
Yeah, that's true. They do take a departure from them, as you were saying before. Yeah, yeah. Where they do try to implement their own style and try to showcase their own talents, their own research, and their own creative vision, because it is very separate to 2001: A Space Odyssey, to Planet of the Apes and whatnot. Even though people expected them to try and replicate it, it's really separating themselves from it. And that's what people, like, and critics who are disappointed that it hasn't become 2001: A Space Odyssey, that's what they've got wrong about their opinions and their perspectives, is because it's not trying to be that. It's trying to be something different.
Yeah.
Which is so unique, and it's really commendable. The way they've done it, even just the guts they had to helm such a project was commendable. But the way they've actually executed that is just outstanding. The cinematography, yes, out in space it's phenomenal. But even back on Earth, it's done really, really well. It's all dark, but the use of colors, it's really something to behold because it uses the mixes of oranges, browns, and greens. These sort yeah. of earthy tones. And it brings them all together to kind of like present this sort of this environment that is very homely, that is very earthy, something that we know.
Yeah.
Like very familiar, I guess. And it really contrasts well with the uses of light and white and blue and stuff out in space. And it's done so well, the uses of color and cinematography and just the choices, the creative choices they've implemented in this film are incredible.
Well, can we talk about my favorite element of the movie?
The music?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah. The soundtrack to this movie. I am going to go buy it after this because it is insanely good.
Hans Zimmer has got to be nominated for an Oscar for this.
Honestly, this was one of the best movie soundtracks I've ever heard. And like the artist is in my top 5 movies of all time. Like this soundtrack rivals that soundtrack. It is so, so appropriate. They don't have any waste of sound in that movie.
I mean, we don't need to explain to you how good of a composer is Hans Zimmer in it.
Yeah,
He's got an incredible resume.
Lion King.
Yeah, he's done Lion King. He's done Pirates of the Caribbean. He's done Last Samurai. He was in Dark Knight and whatnot. So we all know he has that potential there. And he's won Oscars before. However, in this film... my God, he goes into his own element here. It's just his own world there where he really, he feels something unique about this film, and he shows that through his use of strings, through his use of
the
chimes and whatnot. Yeah, it's just
the organ was the thing that really struck me.
Oh, yeah.
Because before this movie, I'd never really kind of equated organs with space. And after this movie, I just see how fitting of an instrument choice that was. And the organ is very powerful in the movie. It's, if you think like massive cathedral church organ, and it's very overpowering, and it adds to the tension so much.
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. It creates this atmosphere of tension, of fear, but also like at the same time hope sometimes.
Yeah.
It's done so well to heighten the tone of the film.
I think that it does something definitely for the kind of awe that people feel when they look at space. Because, you know, in your mind, psychologically, organs are generally equated to, like, church and, like, God. And I think that the awe that people feel within religion was something that is very kind of relatable to the awe that these characters felt when they were in space. I mean, but, like, one character says at one point, you know, all that's separating us from, like, seconds of death is, like, a few sheets of aluminium for us. And I think that that is something that's such, like, it just backs that up. That they are, you know, because of the nature of space travel, isolated in a vast field of nothingness.
Yeah.
And the music really brought out that feeling of isolation.
And I think, yeah, this is where parallels can be drawn between this and Gravity, is that the music in Gravity, the reason why that won the Oscar for Best Score is because the music, no pun intended, intended to showcase the gravity of the actual situation. And it really I utilized the different instruments to show how vast this space is and how immense the world is in comparison to this tiny little person that was Sandra Bullock. And I think in this film, it does the same sort of thing, but to a different effect.
Yeah.
It doesn't try to recreate that in terms of the music showing how vast space is, but it tries to make it more personal. It tries to focus it entirely on the characters and their own relationships, their own position in space, and with other characters, and it does it extraordinarily well. And another thing that I'll talk about in terms of sound design is its ability to use silence as well.
Yes.
When things are happening outside in space, what Gravity did well and what people and critics commended it for was its ability to use silence, and the sounds and the noises it used and the mixing was done from the perspective of the characters. So, like, whatever Sandra Bullock was hearing, it was from the tinkering from inside her suit, whereas, like, when things are flying past, she couldn't hear anything because sound in space, as we all know, is silenced. It's muffled, and in this film, they do a similar thing. They try to use the tinkerings inside the suit. They use the echoes inside the helmet, and it's done really, really well. However, I think one downfall this film has, I think personally it's the only downfall, is that sometimes the music was a bit loud.
See, I actually really liked that. That
it was over the top of talking?
Yeah. There were one or two moments in the film where I think it was Anne Hathaway's voice most of the time was drowned out by the soundtrack. But at least the most memorable moment for me is Anne Hathaway's voice being drowned out by the soundtrack. But I really liked the fact that the soundtrack was overwhelming, because in your mind, the tenseness and the atmosphere of the film becomes overwhelming. And I think that it was appropriate for the music to do that. But I can understand why you wouldn't like that.
Actually, no, thinking about it now, I feel like, well, it was definitely done purposefully. Like, Christopher Nolan wouldn't do that mistakenly.
Yeah.
He's clearly done it for an intention. And I feel like maybe, thinking on it now, he's done it because, the gravity of the situation needs to be more personal. It's when the music is actually louder than the talking, or then people doing commands, or little sounds that are going on outside in the air, in the craft or whatever. It's done really, really personally, such that it's focusing on the character, and the music is drowning everything out because you're focusing on this character and what they're thinking, what they're doing, and the music is amplifying that emotion, and everything else needs to be drowned out. And maybe that's why it was chosen, and I'm starting to rethink my position on this now.
Well, yeah. I do think that this movie, though, like, it doesn't have many flaws, but I think that one flaw that I can give it at least in my mind, was that in one or two instances, mainly towards the end, things happened kind of out of nowhere. And so whilst it was definitely building up for a very specific end to the movie, there were one or two instances where the plot twists kind of happened without really building them up. And so, like, very, very few instances and in a very, very minor way. But for me, it was that one thing that would stop me from giving it a perfect score.
I think, because that's, again, where critics have criticized this movie and where people have come out disappointed in it, is that the plot twists at the end were questionable in that they weren't expected, but they weren't kind of, as you
definitely,
said,
yeah.
they weren't built up in any way.
It definitely takes an unexpected turn in the last act of the movie. But having said that, that's not the plot twist that I was unhappy with. I actually really, really liked the way that the direction that the last act took place.
I think the last act is probably the more complex and the more conflicting in terms of responses.
Yeah.
I personally really enjoyed it.
I loved it.
Despite the fact that it could have ended at a certain point, but it kept going. While the ending probably didn't need to happen the way it did, and it could have ended earlier, which is probably what's keeping me from giving it a perfect score, I feel like the actual plot twists were done incredibly well, and with enough subtlety interwoven throughout the first two acts of the plot to indicate or hint that that was what was going to happen, for me to be okay with that and for me to accept that. Because, it's quite left field and quite a curveball that they throw at you at the end. But I really, really enjoyed that. And because, like, everything seemed to tie well together. And the only thing that's keeping me from giving it a perfect score is what they do after that. Is just that the last 5 to 10 minutes that they do in the film, where it probably should have probably not done, I feel. Because if it ended at a certain point, and if you see the movie, you'll know which point I'm talking about. If it ended at that point, I feel like it would be, for me, a perfect movie.
Yeah. I think I was quite happy with the last couple of minutes of the movie. I definitely knew that they would end it in a way that was kind of different to what you would expect. But one or two things were a little bit predictable. And so I think that anybody who watches way too much TV or movies like me will be able to kind of see the direction that the movie might end up taking. But at the same time, I think literally the only thing that I can really fault it for is that maybe literally just one or two plot twists out of like many, many kind of just came out of nowhere. And that's why I wouldn't give it 5 out of 5, but I would give it something very close.
Okay, so I think, have we exhausted our discussion on it? Are we going to go to ratings?
I think so.
Okay, Martin, what would you rate this film Interstellar out of 5?
Well, given it's just fantastic visuals, scientific basis, music, lack of music in some situations, and all around fantastic acting, I'm going to give it a good 4.75.
Okay. Solid. That's really high.
Yeah.
That is super high.
It is a beautiful movie, and I will see it again. I will buy it on DVD. And I really do suggest you guys see it. It's really that good.
Mm.
Rohan, what would you rate Interstellar?
Interstellar is a movie that I saw having zero expectation as to what it would be like. I heard interesting things, but I was pretty much wowed by every single aspect of the movie apart from one very, very, very small aspect. And it's a movie that I would 100% recommend people seeing, and it's a movie that I would see again. I would go and see it again today.
Yes, for sure.
So
I'm going to go down to the IMAX and watch it out there.
Yeah.
Because the big screen and the visual is incredible.
Definitely. So I would give it 4.85.
Nice. I really, really love this film. I'm unashamedly a Nolan fanboy, but I can detach myself from that subjective analysis and I can view this as a movie as a whole. And even then, I still struggle to find flaws in this movie. Where I found flaws, you know, in the sound editing and the final 10 minutes, I still can't figure out how that can overwhelm my pure enjoyment of this film, my appreciation of the incredible acting, of the graphics, of the dialogue, of the plot and the twists and how out of the blue they were. And yes, they may have been unforeseeable. They may have been, some elements may have been predictable. I feel like it all worked out incredibly well, and it's seamlessly interwoven throughout the entire film, and it's done to an extent that I didn't expect coming in, especially after hearing such criticisms from critics. But for me personally, it is my favorite film of the year. I will continue the trend of giving it a higher score and give it 4.9 out of 5.
Wow.
Yes.
Solid.
It's probably my second favorite Nolan film, next to Dark Knight. Dark Knight gets a 4.99 out of 5.
Ooh.
Yeah, so in conclusion, I'm pretty sure you can all agree if you've seen it. We literally can't even.
Yes. I was having trouble speaking after we walked out of the film because I was so, like, taken aback by how amazing this movie was.
We walked out of the cinema telling each other, okay, no talking about the film until yeah. we start the podcast. So everything yeah. you're hearing here, I haven't heard these guys talk about it yet. So hope you guys enjoy the discussion. We really, really love the film. So definitely go check it out.
Absolutely. See it several times.
Definitely.
Honestly, that was one of the greatest films I've seen. That was one of the greatest movie experiences I've had in my life.
It's an experience. It's a journey. That's what it is. It's not just a movie. It's an experience. It's like Inception in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a greater experience than Inception.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys, it's time to wrap up.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, that's it from us here at The Fiction Fix. Join us next time where we're going to have a Marvel DC podcast, which we have been aching to do, and we're going to review the brand new summer blockbuster for us. I think it's a winter blockbuster for anyone in the hemisphere. The new Hunger Games movie, Mockingjay Part 1.
Yeah, it's super exciting. We've been holding out for that for a while, and also the Marvel and DC discussion. I feel like, because we've been planning that podcast for a long time, and now with all these announcements, we feel like we have to dedicate an entire podcast to it right now.
Yes.
So it's really important that we're going to get that to you guys next time.
You can find us on Facebook at Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionfixofficial.
You can find us on Tumblr at Tumblr, fictionfixofficial.tumblr.com.
Rohan is a failure.
You can find me on Twitter at Rohan Hora.
You can find me on Instagram at Ben Chappell.
And you can find me
in general.
Yes, you can
find I exist.
So give me a second, guys.
I'm so glad you think of something. I think that's good.
We're definitely using that.
Don't forget to check out Toussaint Morrison and his music. Once again, we thank him for allowing us to use his music in this podcast. It's been amazing, and thank you for the ride.
And make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes so that you can get regular automatic updates every time we upload a new episode.
And share us with your friends.
Yes, absolutely. And tell us what you want us to review later on, and any ideas you have for later podcasts.
Until next time, we'll make your podcast you can't refuse. Nobody wanna worry about what you can control. You should go and do you tonight. Be cool, baby, cool, if you get sad. Yeah, I was like... Does anyone want a drink or something?
Yeah, let's go to Pate.
Pate? Wait, did you say part bite to eat or pate?
A bite to eat. Let's do that.
I have a pint to eat, I can't drive you home. To my house anyway.
I mean, I don't think we have alcohol, so...
No, you know, Borderlands, the new one, the pre-sequel, it did a, it's like an entire parody of Australians.
Really?
You should listen to some of the dialogue, it's all about Australia.
Well, I love Australians. Should I say Australians?
Australia!
Australia! Australia!
Sorry, we should be professionals here and follow the podcast.
Apparently we're professionals.
Apparently, well, I mean, they haven't classified us as yet. I mean, we're on iTunes, so we are technically professionals.
If I did this on myself. Technically.
Great.
Thank you very much. Anyway, well, this has gone on way too long.
Okay,
well, much longer than necessary. Well, let's continue on with the podcast. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. We are.
Oh, hey. Whoa. Sorry. I was laughing and snorting in the middle of that. You start again, Martin. Please go ahead. Yeah, we're just like girls at a restaurant.
I literally can't even.
Literally can't even split the bill. Seriously.
Oh my god.
That was so freaking bad. I apologize. Good thing I'm editing this. I can cut that out. Awesome.
Take out. I literally can't. It's very topical considering Red Food released. I literally can't 3 days ago.
You were going to edit everything that you said out, but everything I left.
Yes. That's exactly what's going on. So I do it every time because you're like this source of comedic just genius.
Oh, crap.
It's amazing.
Okay, so...
This is going to the bloopers, BT dubs. Thanks
yeah,
for that.
Okay, cool.
Ever since I found out that Christopher Nolan was helming this exercise, Mon's eating chips in the middle of it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionfiction. I can see why you struggle with this.
Fiction official. Why do we even name that? Why do we give us such a terrible name?
Yeah. In the meantime, we'll make your podcast. No, it's in the next. Until next time. Until next time. We make your podcast. We can't refuse. I keep on messing this up. Seriously, every podcast. This is the one that I
should just keep a single recording of you doing it right, so you have to keep doing it. All right, can I? So that's long enough. Right, I need to redo it. I thought of something. Okay,
and you can find me on the other side.
Come on, no.
What?
Oh, so.
I got it.
And you can find me back in the cinema watching Interstellar for the second time.
And you can find me.
I just like the fact that we use the word gravity so much during Interstellar. Yeah, not only because of the movie Gravity, but also because of the fact that gravity is the big plot point. I want people to understand, watch it and then listen to this and be like, it's like on the nose spoiler references.
Yeah, guys, never mind. Just keep and you can find me.
yeah, we are. I intended to. Trust me. Alright, well, the recording's still going, so I'm really glad about that one. still going. This is awesome. Okay. Well, we're just going to sit here.
Okay, let's stop the recording.
Thanks, Rohan.
Before bed, what kind of night you want to set sail? Although I'm chill with the kinfolk, I will toss that ass through a plate glass window. Make no mistake, from Indiana to Iowa, I step with the family crest and the Iowa. Quiet tight, leader of the pack. You got to fight a flight, but baby, keep it lax. And since Wisconsin, have a drink, sit. Some call me Hulk, but you can call me Chris. Charged up the ride, headed back to La Crosse again. Gotta see the girl one more time. My destiny's just around the bend. And when I slow down, it's not hard to find.